welcome everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I'm going to introduce our speaker for this evening. It's Kathy. And you guys are in for a treat. Even if you've heard her story before, I've heard it a million times, and it's always fresh and new and from the present. And she's a gifted communicator and really has an impactful way, in my opinion, of sharing about her experience and the steps and how God has transformed her life, thank goodness. And, you know, I've known her almost the entire time I've been sober. She's my one and only sponsor, and thank goodness for that, because I needed one. So I love hearing from her, and without further ado, I'll ask her to come up and share.
Thanks, darling.
See, I knew I picked the right person. She'd say nice things about me. Hey, everybody, I'm Kathy Shires, alcoholic. My sobriety day is January 4th of 2007. I have a home group, which is the Fifth Tradition group. We meet on Thursday evenings and Saturday evenings. Please come out at some point if you would like. The Thursday meeting is a book study, and Saturday meeting is a speaker meeting. I also sponsor a gaggle of women that do way more for me than I do for them. I'm thoroughly convinced of that. And I am actively sponsored, which is, all those things are very important, because when I'm not doing one of those things, I'm walking out the door, and I've had that experience too. Listening to the sweet baby in the back a second ago, I kind of giggled because I always forget this in my story. I've been to AA like four times. The first time I was 2 months old, about. My mother needed to get sober really bad, and went to, back before treatment centers were really a thing, down in South Georgia, a doctor and his wife were both sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I mean, he had kind of drank away his practice, and so they used to bring in alcoholics and sober them up and fill them up all in their house when their kids were there and everything. And eventually they moved that out and formed a treatment center, but my mother was a patient there. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I've often thought there were outside things that could fix what's an internal problem. And my mother thought, I'll have a baby. That'll do it. And so she managed to stay sober the entire pregnancy. And I think about when I turned about 6 months is when she went back out. And she never drew a sober breath after that. So the truth is, I owe my very life and limbs and everything to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have seen fetal alcohol syndrome children, and I am convinced I would have been one of those. My mother was not a lightweight, nor am I. And, I mean, my mother died at 39 of this disease. She was on a fast train for death. And I don't think I would have made it, really. When I got sober later and went to that same treatment center, I was a third generation to go there. So that's not really an awesome claim to fame, but they thought I was a novelty, and they took special interest in me because of it. And the old timers that knew my mother back then would say, yeah, we told her to get that baby a white chip, you know. I don't know. Hopefully she won't be telling that story one day, but I didn't get a sponsor then. I didn't hear anything. I didn't want what you had. It's 2 months old. The problem is I needed a spiritual remedy for something that was terribly broken and wrong inside of me for as long as I can remember. I would not have told you that the first thing I remember feeling as a kid was fear, but looking back on that, that's exactly what it was. I certainly was an excitable kid, a very weird kid. I always marched the beat of a different drummer, and certainly wanted to have fun and play. But with me, it always goes in the weird zone. With normal people, And I was mostly going to school and doing things with quote-unquote normal people. That, I mean, as far as I can tell from what I see on Facebook and what I hear through the grapevine, they are not alcoholics. They don't belong in here. But I felt like I had, because I'm the weird girl, and I always go into the weird place, and so very quickly I become extremely scared of what people think of me. And every fist step I've ever done, and everyone I've ever heard, that's usually towards the top of the list, is what you think of me. And so I spend most of my time first trying to identify which personality I need to bring out for you to love and accept me and not know how weird I am. And then the rest of the time pretending to be that. And only part of that was true. It was like some aspect of me, but it wasn't really authentic at all. I was a pretend person. So if somebody really liked me, or God forbid, loved me, they were in love with a figment of my imagination. It wasn't really true. Thankfully, and I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday, the truth always has a way of surfacing. But then I have to just go get a different friend. And go get a different friend, go do something else. Once I drank at 15, I could blame my weirdness and whatever on alcohol. You know, and I could certainly blame, there's other stuff going on inside of me. I'm just awkward. I'm constantly taking my emotional pulse. I don't ever feel quite right. I'm pretty sure that if I just had a little more of that, a little less of that, that relationship later, that amount of money, that living in that place, that I would be sorted out. And I spent my lifetime trying to wrest happiness and satisfaction out of my life and get all my ducks in a row and things just right and staying put. You got to watch them. I mean, that right there creates a level of anxiety because you have to watch people all the time because they're thinking things at you, and you know it ain't thinking good. It's thinking bad, and so you're already coming up with how do I need to present so that you get back to thinking good. I mean, it's all happening in my mind. It's total insanity. Total insanity. And yet I'm walking around pretending to be normal. Oh, my God, I needed a drink when I was 5. But I swore because I saw the horrors of alcoholism in my home. I did not, you know, I have friends that had parents that were well-to-do and had dinner parties at the house, and the kids would be sent upstairs, but they could hear the laughter and the fun, and it's the thing the adults did. That is not my experience. My experience is the cops being called, my mother chasing a random person around the city of Atlanta, shouting at him because she thinks it's my father, busting every window in the house with rocks, and we live in a cul-de-sac, and all the families are there looking. And ultimately, my mother tried to kill my father in a blackout. That's what I thought drinking was, which doesn't. That makes total sense why I thought if you drank, you were a complete and total loser. Like, why? Why would you do that? That'd be crazy to open that kind of door. But as I got to be a teenager, you know, people are starting to drink. And I'm Debbie Downer, kind of reading them the Riot Act. And when I was 15, I finally was away in Florida with my aunt and some friends, and we just concocted this plan to go get drunk and see what that was like. And I sold it pretty well. We can typically talk Al-Anons into a lot of stuff. And I said, we won't leave the condo. We'll be good. We won't drive. We won't do this. And so we bought wine coolers, the 2-liter bottles of every flavor they had at the grocery store. And one of the four of us had played quarters before and some other little drinking games. So I'm a quick study. I'm going to learn all this stuff. I'm going to become an ace. I mean, we are the only people that talk about drinking as a career. I mean, we really study this, like as if I was going to get a medical degree. I'm going to roll the best joint. I'm going to do it just right, right? Drink every guy under the table, that kind of thing. So after an hour, my aunt's really wishing she hadn't gone along with this plan because we didn't leave the condo, but she probably wished we did. There was one yakking in the bathroom, vomit all over the bathroom. Me and the other dude were out on the balcony shouting obscenities and throwing stuff at people at the pool and just being thought it was the most hysterical thing. And I don't know what happened to his other three teenagers that night. but I know what happened to me. And I don't know that I could have put it into words, but it was nothing short of a spiritual experience. All the things that we read when we read the nine-step promises about things slipping away and disappearing and these magical promises happened instantaneously once the alcohol hit my system. And my life made a complete 180 that night because I thought, I'm going to drink as often as I can, as much as I can. And I wasn't able to do that every day at first. There was no alcohol in my home, so I had to talk to some guy outside of a 7-Eleven to buy it or know people that did. But very quickly, all my friends changed. I mean, all I want to know is, where's the party? And very quickly, because I'm a quick study, people are asking me where the party is, because I always know where the party is. I'm the person that knows where the party in the early evening starts and then where we're going after, too. And so the downhill spiral was really, really fast for me. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I was given, you know, alcohol a bad rap. Alcohol's pretty good, but if you do any drugs, that's a problem. And drugs are part of my story. And for the old-timers that get offended, I'm really, really sorry, but most of the young people coming in today are all mixed up in the drugs, too. And it's, take the time to talk to them about the early chapters in the big book to find out whether they're an alcoholic. Because I am absolutely as alcoholic as textbook as that book is saying. But, you know, I'm an everything all the time, more, 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 faster, better, whatever kind of girl. And so when somebody came over with something, I'd be like, I don't know, a little scared about it. But you get me started drinking and all bets are off. And so all that fear would go away. So not only the fear of what you thought of me, but the fear of, like, my safety went away. And so here we go. And I mean, man, 15 to 16, all I did was drink. 16 to 18, it just sailed into the drug world where towards the end, all I'm doing is hanging out with drug dealers because those are the people with the drugs. And so, you know, it's really interesting how even today sometimes, and a self-centered, self-focused person does this, but I can still do this today, is that I will make a judgment about my day based on how I feel about that day. So I wake up, and, you know, that day was kind of awkward or a lot of stuff happened. I would say, you know, today was an awful day because I feel like it was an awful day. I put that stamp on it, right? And other days, you know, I remember this was like one of the best nights. This is what I thought. If I could live like this the rest of my life, I'd be fine. Halloween 1988, go to Omni downtown, saw Rod Stewart, walked after the concert down to the best club in the city of Atlanta, which was Club Rio, and met up with these people I used to party with. We would tip the doorman some drugs, so I'd get in on this really flimsy, ridiculous license. I was 17. Tip the barman some drugs, and we drink free all night. You know, the fancy stuff. It's really expensive with the umbrellas in it and stuff. And I had strangers giving me drugs, and I'd go into the bathroom. Sometimes I had to do some things to get those drugs. They were playing the best music I had ever heard, and people were dressed up in these elaborate costumes. It was the best night of my life. I thought, if I could live here, I don't ever want to go home. This is ideal for me. I would have told you that was the best night, best day I had ever had. My parents would have told you a different story, however. If you ask them, how is she doing? Well, they don't judge how I'm doing on how I'm feeling that particular day. They're judging it on how I'm doing. And they say, we're afraid we're going to get the call that she's dead in a ditch. We never know where she is. She's always lying about where she is. Her grades are starting to suffer. She's like a wild, wild animal. You can't tame it down. You can't keep it caged at all. So it's just really funny because there are other times, like fast forward to 2014 when my dad passed away not too many years ago. I would have told you this is a terrible day. Like they said, how are you doing? I would have said, I not good, because I judge that on how I feel, and I feel blue because my dad's died. But if you ask my sponsor and you ask my husband and other people, how is she doing? They'd say she's doing good. She's still meeting with her sponsees. She's calling me. She's praying. She's doing all those things because they judge how I'm doing on that, what I'm actually doing. That's really what people judge you on. So I was going down to college. I had graduated high school with honors, and I thought in order to be like a drug addict or alcoholic, you must be failing out of school. I mean, the treatment center things that would pop up on the TV said that. That was one of the criteria, right? Is your kid failing out of school, fighting, you know, this, that, and the other thing? And I'd be like, nope, 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 don't have a problem. And again, my vision of an alcoholic was my mother, who was the thing that took a lot of tranquilizers and drank copious amounts of alcohol and just laid on the couch. And because I don't look like that, I thought, not an alcoholic. I'm managing just fine. But I'm going down to South Georgia for school, and my car has been seized because I can't quit running into things. And but I never got a DUI, which, again, I thought was a criteria for being an alcoholic. And I went in on a big buy with my friends, these drug dealers, and the feds came out of the bushes. And in a second, my bank account was frozen, my car was seized, and again, my life changed on a dime. And, like, this was blowing my mind. Like, I skipped all the other, like, minor offenses and went straight to the big time. The universe, it's kind of funny how that works. Because a DUI would have been... that'd have been nothing to me. Everybody got DUIs. Like, so what? You know, pay the money, do the community service, laugh about it. Like, it would have been nothing. I drove intoxicated all the time. I have no problem with it at all. I mean, you got to get somewhere. And I'm such a control freak. I'm not going to let you drive, because I also have this thing like, what if I want to leave the party? What if there's a better party? I want to be able to leave when I want to, go where I want to, completely sort of keep control when obviously things are spiraling out of control. And I tried when I went down to college and started college. I'm in that part where they're doing all the legal things before they sentence you. I mean, I was clearly guilty. And so I'm trying to stay sober. What I'm trying to do actually is kick it old school and go back to drinking like at keg parties. I thought, well, this is college. Start drinking kegs again. And I couldn't do it because I'm an everything all the time kind of gal. And going back to drinking beer, even lots and lots and lots and lots of beer, wasn't going to do it. And so, you know, I'm in a lot of trouble because I've had a couple of dirty tests and the judge wants to talk to me, which is paranoid code for he wants to lock you up immediately. And so I thought, okay, today's the day I'm going to kill myself, because I've been thinking about that a lot. Because I just wanted out, you know. I did not have a God in my life at all. For many years of my early childhood, if you asked me if I believe in God, I would have said yes. But, I mean, I was probably 13 when I started thinking, do you really believe in God, you know? Where was this God when all that stuff was happening in your house? You know, either God doesn't care about you or doesn't exist. And it was a lot easier pill to swallow that God did not exist, that it was just the biggest lie. It was like somebody finally telling you the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus don't exist. Oh, right. It makes perfect sense. All the things fall into place. It makes perfect sense. And so I did not have any kind of spirituality, and I just wanted out. I was sitting on the couch trying to figure out how to do it with the least amount of pain, with the maximum drama. You know, because if I could have slit my wrist and not had that pain and just slung my blood all over the walls like that for my parents to see, you'd feel so bad. That's kind of what I really wanted, but I don't like blood. So I was sitting there trying to concoct the plan, and then came up one of those commercials on the TV for Charter Petersburg. And it was the same silly commercial. Has your child failing in school? Is he getting into fights? Is it going to all this kind of stuff? Is he talking about suicide? And I called the number. I don't know what I was expecting. I don't know if I was really reaching out for help. I don't know. I just called it. And they brought me in, and they worked it out for me to come into Petersburg Hospital. And that began my second journey into AA, if you want to count the first one where I was a baby. I had no intention of staying sober. I went there because I knew I could kind of hide from the feds in this hospital. And they weren't going to drag me out of there because they wanted me to bust my friends. And I really thought, you know, I am crazy. So perhaps I can go through some therapy and some medications and some kind of, you know, psychological regimen to fix me, and then maybe I'll be able to go back and drink and use occasionally, like a normal person, you know, whatever that looks like. I have never desired really to drink or use like a normal person, I promise. But that was the lie my head was saying. And I went to a long-term extended treatment after Peachford to South Georgia, and something happened. You know, they were all about just about the big book. They had a, this is the early 90s, so it was a tape recorder with cassette tapes, and they would pull out certain speakers they thought you would relate to, and you had your big book, and that was it. There was no medication. There was none of the psychological stuff. It was just AA. We're just going to take you to AA. That's it. And I don't know, at some point I graduated from being a total atheist, where you could not tell me a single thing, up the rung, I guess, to being agnostic. Again, I'm judging everything on how I feel, and I would feel really, I don't know, something electric, something really nice at a meeting when we would circle up to say the Lord's Prayer, which I did not know when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am a quick study. By meeting three, I got it. Because I'm going to mumble it. You don't know that I don't know this, because I'm never telling you I don't know something. And then I quickly learned that. And the old timers were really kind to me. You know, I saw something in their eyes, and they were very kind to me, and they would talk about God, and I could tell that they believed it, and I was willing to believe that maybe they weren't stupid. Because most of the time, people would stand up here like this, and they would talk about some of their drinking escapades and the way they felt as an alcoholic and all of that, feeling like they never fit in, and then feeling like alcohol was amazing at first, and then it did a number on them. And I'm right with them, toe-to-toe. And then they would talk about coming to AA and how they worked the steps and got a sponsor and got in touch with a higher power, and I was like, another one bites the dust, because now you're stupid. And now I discount everything you said before. But when I saw these old-timers, I just chose to believe they weren't stupid. And so I thought, just like we agnostic says, I wish I had what that old-timer has. There's something in his eyes I wish I could pull out and put in me. What I did not understand was I was not doing Alcoholics Anonymous in the way you're supposed to be able to reduce that ego that thinks it knows everything and affect a relationship, a contact with this God. I heard they told me to pray on your knees, and they even showed me prayers in the book. And still to this day, I don't do a lot of other spiritual reading sometimes, but most of the prayers I say and most of the stuff I do is just, it's an AA God. It comes out of the big book. It's never served me wrong. So I get on my knees, and I feel so awkward, you know. I remember being 5 years old and singing, like, Olivia Newton-John and different singers, and have my hair brushed. And I thought the paparazzi were out the window. I think I'm so important, right? Well, I'm hoping I was wrong, because I'm praying on my knees feeling so stupid, and I hope nobody will ever see this. And if somebody, I'm locking the door. I don't want anybody to ever walk in. This feels really, really lame. But I could have prayed till the cows come home, and I wasn't going to change unless I worked the 12 steps. And it's pretty insane to come to a 12-step program and not do 12 things. But I heard the treatment center say, you change your playmates, your playgrounds, your playthings. Check, check, check. I mean, the playmates were easy. As soon as I got arrested by the feds, they just scattered like roaches when you turn the light on. That wasn't a problem. And I went to the meetings, and I shared in every meeting, whether I had any experience with it or not. I mean, it's funny, my husband and I laugh about this a lot, because he was much like me for several years. A young person running around with young people sober, having a ball, staying sober on fellowship. And, you know, like, let's take the NAVA Club. You know, you can come to, like, an 11 a.m. meeting and hear some amazing jewels. So, like, in your newcomer, your mind's being blown all the time. People are saying these nuggets that are amazing. I'm so jealous of newcomers, because you've been out here a long time, it just gets you get jaded. But your mind's being blown all the time. These are the most spiritual, smartest people you ever know. It's amazing. And then, but then you take that little nugget you heard at 11 o'clock, and then you go to the 5:30. And then you share it like it was your own, right? I mean, I can develop an AA personality. I'm a quick study, you know? And then somebody comes up to me and go, I really like what you shared. You know, that really got me. I'd be like, keep coming back. It works. Absolutely. A fake, a fraud, a total phony. You know, zip up in an AA recovery suit in your car and walk in. My ego can take anything and use it to kill me. And I was dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But mostly it's because, like I said, I went to that treatment center at 18 not believing I had alcoholism. A lot of people get here too soon because their circumstances shove them in the door, you know. We welcome them always. Hopefully we plant some seeds. We don't necessarily expect it to flourish. But it was like you were presenting a treatment for a bum knee when I was going, no, it's my elbow. This is what hurts. This is what the problem is. Why am I going to take your rehab for a bum knee? That don't make any sense, right? So I didn't. I was court-ordered to do therapy after I got out of prison. I did have to serve 6 months in a federal penitentiary the first year of my sobriety. The whole first year of my sobriety, I was locked up, whether I was in treatment or in jail. And so I spent the next 3 years going to college, like I said, being a good girl, going to your meetings, having friends in AA, paying back my restitution to the government, doing all these things. What I didn't realize is that I was taking a third step that looked kind of like this. All right, God, here's my life, and I'll be a good girl, and I'll do the sober thing, which is really awkward for a young person. But now here's a list about how my life better go. And between year 3 and 4, it wasn't going so hot, you know. And I had no foundation and no tools to fall back on. And I was angry at this so-called God, because I thought God was testing me and meddling in my life. And I don't have that sort of conception of God today. But, you know, I mean, the people in AA gave me my first conception, because when I wasn't sure whether I was going to have to go serve my time or whether they were going to change my order and make me stay in this extended treatment center, they said, pray for God's will. Oh, God, that was such terrible advice. Because I prayed for God's will. And then when I went to prison, guess who sent me there? I thought God sent me there. The youngest person out of 2,000 people in Lexington, Kentucky. Terrified. Absolutely terrified. I didn't understand at all. And so, again, I have the thing, well, if I can just get all my ducks in a row and, you know, whatever it is I'll be happy when I get X, Y, and Z. It's just not what it is now. And I thought, if I could just get out from South Georgia, I don't want to live with my grandmother anymore. So these people here, these meetings, I want to go back to Atlanta. That's my home. I want to be there. If I can get a career job, which I'm not sure I can get with 2 felony convictions for conspiracy, you know, and get a little apartment on my own, my life will come together. It'll blossom. And I got all of those things. You know, the only thing I didn't have was a boyfriend, but I was so thrilled with the job and the apartment for a second, that wasn't on my radar yet. That was coming, like, probably next week. But I was really happy with the situation, and I came to NABA Club. I sat over there, and I picked up my 4-year chip. And 3 days later, I was drinking. Because what's wrong with me was not caused by my outside circumstances. It was not caused by my upbringing. It was not caused by anything out here. And it can't be fixed by anything out here. And believe me, I've known that for a long time, and I still sometimes think maybe that new car will do it. Maybe X amount of money will do it. I still get delusional that way. But the truth is none of that is made it a problem or will fix the problem. And on that relapse, I was out there for a few months, and all I did was drink. And that was probably really important, because I drank my way into alcoholism. I watched what happened to my mind. I watched the progression over a couple of months, where it started off with just one beer. But I mean, if you've been sober for 4 years, a good sized beer will probably get you pretty tipsy. And I was good with tipsy. You know, by the end, I'm drinking my 12-pack, taking yours, vomiting on the floor, what always used to happen. And see, because I can't stand being the projectile vomit girl, the next thing you know, I'm going to pick up some kind of speed. And then I can drink as much as I want. Let's go out, we're going to the club, stay up all night, you know, that whole thing. I knew that was what was coming, and I did not mean to get sober again. I had a friend from South Georgia visit me at this little apartment. She sniffed out a rat, realized I had drank again, even though I wasn't drinking that day. My whole demeanor had changed. And the next day she said, well, I'm going to go to a meeting. Would you come with me? I said, sure. So I sat right about where Ryan's sitting, and I came to the meeting, so what, back here at NABA. And I don't know what the topic was. I'm pretty sure it was a discussion meeting of some kind. And at the end, the chairperson said, as I often heard back those days, you know, does anybody have any burning desire to share? And usually, because I'm a butthole, Well, I say something like, you know, there's a cream for that. He said, are there any burning desires? And my hand went up. It was like I didn't make it go up. I swear. And they called on me. And I said, I don't know what's wrong with me, but a few months ago I picked up a 4-year chip. I've been drinking ever since. And I don't know what you have, if I want what you have. But I know I don't want what I got. And it started on the second journey in AA. And it didn't take a rocket science to say, okay, what happened? How'd you lose your 4 years? I mean, it's pretty obvious. You were a meeting maker. And those things, I used to hear a lot of falsehoods in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things they used to say is, you know, meeting makers make it. You know, meeting makers make meetings. But show me which of those 12 steps says go to a meeting. That's not the prescription that's on offer. We can't do this alone. We got to do it together. But that's not how we change. That's not how we get in touch with God. You know? But I used to hopefully, you know, and somebody related to me this way. Have you ever gone to a bar and sat next to somebody drinking and watched them and got drunk because they were drinking shot after shot after shot? Of course not. You have to drink and do exactly what they're doing toe-to-toe to get the effect they're getting. But I hope that if I just sat near people in AA, that somehow it was just, I was going to catch it. You know, it was just going to gleam on me. Because I'm always looking for the easier, softer way, the most convenient. You know, I don't want it to be hard or, you know. And mostly, I wanted to still be able to do what I wanted to do, which is why I wasn't ready. And so I asked somebody to sponsor me, somebody that a dude recommended. Said, ask that woman over there. She said, hey, you got a big book? And I said, yep, it's one of those. I had it for 4 years because Fisher gave it to me. And the binding was like crack. I mean, it had never been opened. I never went to big book meetings. Those people try to tell you what to do. And so I go to step meetings because if you're just sitting, you know, reading the step in the 12 and 12 and talking about it for an hour, isn't that kind of like you did it? I mean, that's what I thought. We're philosophizing about the steps. And so we met once a week and went through that book line by line, paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter. And she did not give me extra busy work to do. We prayed when it said to pray. We wrote when it said to write. And that's it. And when I was 3 months sober, I was over at Skyland. And they give out the chips before they split up into various meetings. I cried for the whole meeting. Still feeling like a piece of crap that I had given away my AA trophies. But by the time I got my 6-month chip at that same meeting, I was on top of the world. So it doesn't have to take a long time if you mean business and get busy and get a confident sponsor and let's go. And so I was willing to become a seeker of God. I really knew I needed a relationship with this God. And I was willing to go through the roadmap of trying to squash down me, squash down my ego so that I could have a relationship with whatever this power of the universe was. I did not know that I was the one standing in the way of that. And some amazing things happened. Like I was like a year and a half sober, and somebody asked me to sponsor them. Like, nobody's asking me when I was sober those 4 years. Of course not. Of course not. I would have killed people for sure. Don't work my program. My program consisted of, like, drive by and see if the cute guy's car's in the parking lot, then pull in, chat them up outside the meeting. Go get a cup of coffee first, you know. But leave the steps and the sponsor and all that stuff over there. It was a program for failure for sure, but I meant business, and things started happening. I started having a psychic change. I started being a different person. I had the experience, much like what the doctor's opinion says, when he says, you know, I saw this guy, and he's a really bad alcoholic, a nervous, despairing wreck, just a mess of a human being. He accepts the plan outlined in the big book, but he doesn't see the guy for a year, and then he sees him, and he can hardly bring himself to believe he even met him before. Because he was so different. And I had that experience going back down to South Georgia after I had worked the steps and done a bunch of stuff here in Atlanta and was involved with AA here. And the people down there were like, what happened to you? Because you're not like you were. And I was happy to tell them. I was thrilled to tell them. If you work the steps, you can't help but tell somebody. Because the change is miraculous. Just one problem, though. Like I said, I'm a good student, but I'm one of those, I'm going to stay up all night and cram for the test, make 100 on the test or definitely an A on the test, and then I'm going to forget about all that stuff. You know, I'm a results-oriented person. And again, the least amount of time, the least amount of effort. And so I kind of feel like I did the steps and approached A the same way. I will be your star student, and I will come in here and work the steps and write the best inventory anybody ever wrote, and I'll make all these amends, and I'm going to get the result that you get from that. And the result is a spiritual awakening. But then once you've done that, that's kind of done, right? So I'm taking people to the big book, so the literature is fresh. I'm going to meetings. I have service commitments and things like that. But I cannot avoid the fact that I'm going to get angry sometimes. I'm going to get fear. I'm going to get all kinds of self-pity and doubt. I'm going to have issues. The book's really clear. When these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them, talk to somebody about them, turn our thoughts to somebody we can help. I don't know if I was praying when those things would happen. I sure as heck was not calling anybody when those things were happening. I am going to take care of it myself because I'm a self-reliant nightmare. All I was doing was a third of helping people. And so, but the well's going dry. And my husband and I met, and we moved. So he was going to start grad school. We moved to Connecticut for 3 years, went to London, England for 4 years. And every time I moved, I thought I had to have a new sponsor in the new place. And the one in Connecticut was all right, but I couldn't find one in England. And even if you ask my husband who could have sponsored it, he's like, I don't know. We end up starting groups every place we moved, which says a lot about what we think about the AA in that area. I didn't understand that I could have been sponsored long distance. I'm sponsored long distance today. She lives in Virginia. It means I have to put out a lot of effort to stay in contact with her. I wish I could see her regular at meetings, but she promises that she goes, no, you don't. She goes, I'm a nightmare. You really don't want to see me. I can seem really, really amazing and spiritual and whatever because we talk on the phone, but if you saw me all the time in the meetings, you'd be like, that's the woman that's been sponsoring me for 13 years. Yeah, she's crazy. So I was in England, and I'm dying of untreated alcoholism within the rooms. And I have two small boys that are like 2 and 4, and they are the cutest things in the world. But they are driving me absolutely crazy. They are running around screaming, bloodying each other, just, it is madness. My husband has work and his PhD, so he's away from the house, and he comes home, and I swear to God, I just envision him coming home and putting his hand on the door to feel what the temperature is like before he walks in. Because he don't know whether it's going to be a good day, whether I'm going to be in the corner crying and literally shaking, like I have had a nervous breakdown, or if I'm going to be running around chasing them with a hairbrush, screaming at the top of my lungs. That's the best I can do on my own power. And I just, again, thought, I'm not happy now. But I'll be happy when we get back to Atlanta, we get back from familiar meetings and familiar faces, and I have some support, and it's not just me in this house with these boys and blah, blah, blah. But by the time I came back, I had about 7 to 8 years in that range, and I had been managing my life so much and navigating it, I was like way out in the ocean and couldn't see land. And had such an ego that had continued to build that I just couldn't I couldn't humble myself enough to say, I'm dying, I need to start over like a newcomer. I love people that do that with time. I wish I had been able to do that. But I held on again because I must have a high tolerance for pain. But one of the realities of life is that just because we're sober and just because we do a lot of service work, we're not promised a rose garden. And a lot of crappy things can happen. You know, it rains and snows on everybody. It's not about deserving it. It's just what it is. That's how life is. I don't have a program trying to accept life on God's terms. I'm trying to accept life on life's terms. It's just life. And God will help me do that. There's certain things I have to do to keep my ego squashed. And I wasn't doing those. The snow, the blizzard came to our house and just landed there and just kept dumping the snow. And first was my daughter was born, and we were so thrilled we were having a girl. And, you know, I don't know if you heard this, but, you know, when you're pregnant, they'll say, oh, what do you want? You want a boy or girl or, you know, whatever. And the response you often hear is, oh, we don't care really, as long as it's healthy. But what happens if it's not? My pregnancy was textbook. I don't know why. It happened, but they did a scan and they realized she was full term, that she had a stroke. And they had to take her by C-section. And I got to see her for a second, hold her for a second, and off she went to the children's hospital. And I've had a C-section, and I'm helpless, can't leave this bed. And I get a phone call as I'm laying there. Bad news after bad news. My grandmother, who was like my mother was an only child, I'm an only child, so I was like her daughter in some ways. And she had fallen trying to change a stupid light bulb, and it shattered her leg. And she never went home again. She stayed in assisted living for 18 months, and it was one thing after another. Breast cancer, then broke a hip. And I mean, it was just everything you could think of until she died. You know? And I don't really believe God's testing me and blessing me or cursing me, depending on the day or the moment. I just don't have that relationship. If you do, that's cool. I just don't. But I remember laying there thinking, you know, if I'm wrong, and if God really is a puppet master orchestrating all this stuff, if there really is a grand plan that he's got every day planned out for you, this makes perfect sense. Because it's high time that I get what I deserve. I deserve this child with special needs because I've been a horrible mother to those boys. I envisioned that one day they would be in a psychiatrist conversation saying, my mother is neurotic and totally ruined my life. That's what I said. Why wouldn't they say it, right? We have a lot of support from AA and Al-Anon, bringing casseroles for our house and cleaning our house and mowing the grass, and they all came together and rallied around us, which is really sweet. I didn't know we would, since we weren't a church-going family, I didn't think we'd ever have that kind of support. That was really cool. But they gave me painkillers because I had a C-section. And I took every one of them things, whether I needed them or not. Because the truth is, yeah, they say, you know, some people keep them in their cabinets for, I don't know, a rainy day, something happens. Man, it's always raining on my parade. There's always a reason. And I had no business handing those out to myself after that. But nobody would have thought with 10 years sobriety, 11 years sobriety, that would happen. 10 years. And in short time, I'm going down to see my grandmother, and I'm going through her cabinets, taking her pills. And finally, there's a treatment for my alcoholism. Those pills did just fine. And about 9 months later, a few months later, my husband fell and hurt his leg, and so he had to have major surgery. Was off his leg for 6 weeks, and so I pilfered his meds. And 9 months later, I'm using 25 a day, round the clock. And adding a diet pill in the morning, because why not? And taking an Ambien at night, go to sleep, because I am so jacked up, I could clean the bathroom with a toothbrush, you know. Totally crazy. And my husband didn't know, and my sponsees didn't know, and I was a chairperson of a home group, they didn't know. I have a level of dishonesty that I am so comfortable with, where I can lead a double life that defies all reasoning. I remember one time, this is just one of those little times when, you know, you have those moments of clarity where you kind of feel like you ain't right. We were driving home from my home group, and I think I got sober a month or so after this. So it was towards the end when I'm using them round the clock. And my husband had heard me share our little book study for our old home group that we started here in Atlanta. And he said, you know, I don't know when I love you more than when I hear you share in an AA meeting. And I had probably taken about 20 hydrocodone that day. I thought, I was driving home thinking, he's in love with a figment of your imagination, a pretend person. But you know what? A couple pills take care of that. I mean, pesky guilt. I have no time for that. So take some more, move on. Finally, I got to a place where the very beginning of 2007, like I said, I got sober January 4th, so like the first couple of days, you know, I'm thinking, you're using 25 a day now. So what does it look like in a year? 50 a day? Can you get that many? Can you live? I knew I had to get sober. I was really, that whole thing about being sick and tired of being sick and tired, I had never really fully understood and got on board with that saying, but I was. And so I had to sit my husband down to start over. And what I realized was, I don't get to just do some kind of one pass through the steps, and then I have a change, and then I stay there. This is a way of life. I had a mentor in AA, and it made it perfect sense to me when he said, you know, Not everybody in AA has chronic alcoholism. Sounds like you do. And unfortunately, chronic means you never get over it. It always gets worse, not better. You always have to treat it, much like diabetes. Once you've got diabetes, you've got diabetes. My dad got diagnosed after he fell out one time, and he's very overweight. They said, okay, you need to lose 25, 30 pounds, avoid these foods. We're going to put you on these tablets. We'll find the right combination. And it took a while, but they got it going. And he was good for about 5 years until his numbers weren't. And so then they said, you know what, probably need to lose another 10 pounds. We're going to try a stronger medication, you know, whatever. And again, he's like he jumped ahead of the disease for a while, but it was always progressing. Toward the last few years of his life, he's taking insulin shots in the stomach, all that stuff. And it wasn't because he didn't follow the diet. It's because it's chronic. It's progressive. And what progresses when I'm sober is my ego. So I have to do more over time, not less. This is not an acute condition that you treat really hard because you're desperate and I'll do anything. I just don't want to feel like this. And then you go, wow, you know, I'm starting to feel really good. Maybe I only have half as much alcoholism as I used to. You know, it doesn't work like that. And so I'm the person that has to do all of it. I don't have to want to do all of it. That is not a criteria. I just have to do it. I've had hard sponsors in my life, and they did not care how I felt, and they did not care what I thought about it. We would talk about it for a second, and they just said, just do it because I said so, because I like to argue. And so I got in and stayed in, you know, and so it took a long time. I had a pink cloud that first time I was in treatment and all that. That was awesome. I even had a second pink cloud the second time because I was finally worked the steps. And I kind of became a born-again big book thumper, you know, one of those annoying people. But I still had a second pink cloud. I did not have a pink cloud that last time. I felt like I had dug this hole so deep. And it felt like there was nobody else to help me out. I'm having to grasp on those little roots in the soil to pull myself up. And it was terrible. Finally, after about a year of sobriety where I would be plunged into depression and then the clouds would appear and I'd go back into it again. And I spent a lot of time crying at meetings thinking, I can't be like Dr. Bob. I can't want to drink for 2 straight years. I won't make it. I will crack. Thankfully, the obsession to use or drink was lifted from me. It just took a lot longer than I would have liked. And, you know, what I'm like today, I don't know that I'm the best person to tell you that, you know. I would like to say that I'm an AA doer. I'd like to say that I look like somebody who believes they owe Alcoholics Anonymous their life, because I absolutely do. I spend a lot of time, 90% of my day, 80-90% of my day, it seems like, are spent doing things I don't want to do. I don't want to clean the kitchen. I don't want to go to that meeting. I don't want to meet with that sponsee. I don't want to write this inventory. I don't want to do that. I mean, this is what my brain says. You don't want to do that. And you do a lot of stuff. I'm sure it'll be fine tonight, you know. This is what's happening in my head still all the time. And I just go, God, please, just help me just do this one thing. Get me this meeting. And it's fine. Help me just meet with the sponsee. It's fine. You know, help me set myself aside. All these things that are swirling around in my head. You know, show up and be useful. My daughter is the best kid I got, in some ways. The easiest kid I got. What I thought was such a horrible tragedy, I found a level of selflessness inside of me and giving that I didn't know was there. I mean, I always was like, okay, fine. We'll have kids, but I'm putting in my 18 years, and then they go. They're out of here. I still feel like that. And my daughter, I don't think will ever live independently. I don't think she'll ever drive. She's 15. She has no, I mean, that's so scary. She has the mentality of like a 7-year-old. You know, I can't imagine her working. I don't know what the future will hold. I may not be right, but I have totally accepted and I'm totally good with her living in our house till the end of days. And thankfully, I have been financially blessed to be able to make that happen. And that's totally fine. Which is not me. You know? I like to not be needed. Some mothers really love to be needed. They feel a sense of purpose and all. No, no, no. I'll work with newcomers that are super duper needy, and I'll get you through the steps as quickly as possible so you'll become low maintenance for me. That's how I like it. When they start calling me going, I got this new girl to work with, and I don't know, I'm afraid I'm going to, I'm like, oh, yes, the path to the dark side is now complete. Now she's calling me talking about how to help people and not about her stuff all the time, and that's awesome because I know they're going to be fine and they're going to be less trouble for me, you know. But I also have to keep a new one coming in all the time because they're the ones that take up my time and help me. My house is a really peaceful house most days. In May, I will be married 24 years, which is unbelievable. Knowing that we did not come from a lot of good role models. And we were serial daters in AA and crazy young people and all this stuff. And we had an AA Al-Anon couple sit us down and talk, teach us how to work those traditions in the home. If they can keep a crazy bunch of alcoholics in a group working and functioning effectively, surely they can do something in this household. And the most amazing thing is not even that I've been married that long, it's that we never fight. You know? So, I mean, the fighting is usually me going in there washing dishes, going, you know, just like blowing off steam, doing some work, you know? And then coming back later, and I was like, you know what? I was wrong. You know, making it right, moving on. And I'm really grateful. I'm really grateful that I used to fight against the fact that I thought life wasn't fair. And so I'm going to try not to care about that. And I'm going to be really hard as nails. And I walked around with my chip on my shoulder, and some people think I still have that. I'm the most intimidating person in my home group, apparently. And I still don't know what can be done about it. But that's how they feel. No matter, I mean, I can love you, I can adore you, I want you to think I'm awesome, and they're terrified of me. So I must have cultivated that really well. But I'm really glad that life isn't fair today. Because if life was fair, and I got what I deserved, I certainly wouldn't have the life I have today. That is useful and purposeful, and most of the time peaceful. And AA has fixed all the stuff that was wrong inside of me. AA and God. And I'm just so grateful that I know exactly what was always wrong with me. And I would say there's something wrong with me. You're right. There was something wrong with me. And that the solution is actually free, fairly easy, a little inconvenient perhaps, but pretty simple. And it works really, really well. So to any newcomers, I'm glad you're here and I hope you keep coming back. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Great honesty. And Ryan, he's going to give out the chips. I got them lined up right here for you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Ryan. I'm an alcoholic. To denote our time in sobriety, we have a chip system. And anyone coming in for the first time or coming back want to give up that way of life and start anew? You got a white chip? Anyone? Nope. For 30 days, we have a silver chip. 2 months. Anyone got 2 months?
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand and try and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, have some mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. Shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadows of doubt. as I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against. Well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its sting and the lessons fall of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky, till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.